Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 661, Walking the Snake in the Middle East, Part 2, O.J. Agonistes and Palestinian Pornography. This program is being recorded on January 25th of the year 2008. Before getting into the main body of the broadcast, let me urge you in the most extreme fashion to utilize the vast amount of material on the SpitfireList.com website. As I speak on January 25th of 2009, all of the old archive shows, all of the AFAs, formerly RFAs, the Guns of November, the miscellaneous archive shows, and all of the lectures are all available for download for free on MP3, not to mention a vast cornucopia of anti-fascist information, books, long article-length descriptions of lectures and programs. There's nothing like it in the world, and frankly, it's what I've spent my life putting together, and also the heroic efforts of a number of people over the years, archives on audio, Spitfire, the current webmaster who's been burning the midnight oil to get this done. A big tip of the hat to all of them, and also a big tip of the hat to those many people over the years, over the decades, over really the better part of 100 years, who have sacrificed in order to fight fascism. Please utilize the website because this program will exemplify why you need to use the website. There'll be a lot of information in the description for this program that I will not have time to put in the main body of the broadcast itself. As I've said before, if you're only listening to the programs as they're broadcast on the radio, you're missing the vast bulk of the For the Record experience. And by the way, in the spirit of voluntarism that President Barack Obama has signaled, I strongly encourage people to do what they can. Use the information. Download everything, if you can, onto your hard drive. Disseminate it to other people. It's all there. The For the Record shows also exist on what's called a torrent file, which makes file sharing easy. There's just a huge amount of information. So please consider yourselves a one-man or one-woman repository for this type of information, and also do what you can to make things better. One project that is a very doable thing would be for people to go to their local libraries and see if you can't prevail on them to start carrying some of the books that I talk about on this program. The Beast Reawakens by Martin Lee, Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan, Dr. Mary's Monkey by Ed Haslam, and the many titles that I talk about on this program. And also, try to get your local radio station, your local community radio station, to carry the programs. They're made available for free to various radio stations. Now, the title of the broadcast, Walking the Snake in the Middle East, Part 2, refers to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, about which I've had a great deal to say and write over the years. In the interests of saving time here, I'm not going to go into it in any detail. Suffice it to say that after going underground and building up their economic muscle, gaining control of the opinion-forming media in the U.S. and elsewhere, and after precipitating a major crisis in the Middle East, the U.S., by this point, under Nazi domination, after the Nazis have infiltrated the military and taken over the country after it's been devastated by a series of terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction, martial law is declared. In the end, the U.S. launches a preemptive nuclear strike on Israel in combination with a number of other countries, including Turkey. And sort of the idea is good riddance, man. The Israelis had it coming. And what we're going to be looking at in this part of the program is not only the use of the media as not only propaganda, but really in the cases that we're going to examine, really sort of strategic weapons of war. And we're going to be looking also at the media. In particular, I'm going to be doing some ranting. And yes, there's going to be a little bit of ranting in this program about one of the things that I despise most on this earth, and that is television. I hate television, and it's a well-placed hatred, if I do say so myself. Television is bad for you, people, and again, in the spirit of rebirthing slash voluntarism, so to speak, with Barack Obama now having assumed the office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you could do no better than to stop watching television because it's bad for you. You not only get fed a bunch of BS in terms of information, which by and large you do. There is some decent information on television, but not much. But television is bad for your brain. Ultimately, it will cause the physical disintegration of the brain, much like drugs or alcohol. Television has been proven to A, shorten dull synaptic response, B, shorten attention span, C, interfere with brainwave patterns and sleep, and D, it is very widely suspected of being a major contributor to Alzheimer's disease, but research into that has been attenuated by the fact that many of the giant pharmaceutical companies that manufacture drugs to treat Alzheimer's disease advertise on television and won't underwrite that kind of research. TV is bad for you. Get out of the habit of watching it. In fact, with the new HD TV switchover technology, this would be a real good time to lose television. And it doesn't matter, folks, if you watch nothing but the History Channel and Masterpiece Theater, it's still going to disintegrate your brain. And it may seem like a good idea now, and it may seem like a good babysitter if you're trying to keep the kids occupied. Well, later on in life when you have Alzheimer's and your kids are having you euthanized because they can't afford to pay for the medical care, it might not seem like such a good idea. Of course, at that point, you won't care. Not about that and not about much of anything else. But one of the striking things to me about, the political landscape in general, but in particular some of the past the point predictable media coverage coming out of the latest Middle East bloodletting fiasco is just how television is reshaping not only political culture, but intellectual and cognitive culture in general. So I'm going to be talking about that, but we're going to get into a discussion, and once again I'm going to compare the O.J. Simpson case with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and also I'm going to read a little bit of an article, and again, this exemplifies why listeners should use the written description. There's going to be a lot of information in the written description to this program, as well as for 660, which was not in the original broadcast. There are the two things that I've covered over the years that are most distasteful to cover are the O.J. Simpson case and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the complete absence of reason and moderation in the response to coverage of that is very similar to both, and it's just we're going to be talking about both, primarily obviously the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but going into any program I do about this, I just wince, and I'm going to be reading a little bit of a column by Ethan Bronner of the New York Times, who describes a very similar reaction. He does not deal with the O.J. Simpson case, but he wrote a very eloquent piece for the New York Times of today, January 25th, talking about how extremely unpleasant it is to deal with that issue, because it just you catch a blitzkrieg from either side. But television is really shaping our political culture and doing so in an extremely destructive fashion. And the one-eyed beast, I call it the beast, is going to be a major element of the discussion today, because Serpent's Walk really is taking place. And what we're seeing in the Middle East is not only a fundamental distortion of political and historical reality, but also a reshaping of political cognition that ultimately is going to prove extremely destructive. But before we get into that, I want to tie this in with what we were talking about in part one. Now, part one, for the record, 660, was called Walking the Snake in the Middle East, part one, the von Bolschwing legacy. In that program, we talked about Otto von Bolschwing, Eichmann's superior in administering, quote, Jewish matters for the Third Reich. He also, von Bolschwing, that is, was also a key Nazi spy in the Middle East, and in combination with Jack Philby, a British intelligence operative, anti-Semite, double agent for the Third Reich, and King Ibn Saud, another Third Reich ally and the founder of the dynasty that rules Saudi Arabia. He put together, von Bolschwing, that is, put together a stratagem in which, by getting the British and other allies to espouse Zionism and the deliberate resettling of Jews in the Middle East with an eye toward establishing a Jewish homeland, this could be used as sort of a global slash geopolitical agent provocateur device in order to not only, to alienate the Arab and Muslim world, to drive them into the arms of the Axis, and also, I would add, in the post-war period, the Underground Reich and the Underground Axis, and also there, in by so doing, to give control of the Earth Island and the petroleum industry to the forces of fascism. And in the case of the petroleum industry, that's pretty much a done deal. You study the history of fascism, and you cannot but study the consummate involvement of the petroleum industry with the forces of fascism. Now, another of the things that we talked about in connection with the von Bolschwing strategy of using Zionism as sort of a geopolitical agent provocateur element in order to alienate Muslim slash Arab sentiment, thereby gaining control of the Earth Island and the petroleum industry. We should not fail to note that Otto von Bolschwing's protege, Helena von Damm, picked all of the personnel from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments. Basically, that was when the underground Reich went overground and assumed formal stewardship of the American government. And I mention that because with George W. Bush having taken his leave, finally, in Washington, D.C., we should not lose sight of the fact that the people who were junior players under the von Bolschwing, von Damm, von Reagan administrations, and also the von Bush I administration, the junior players in the von Bolschwing, von Damm, von Reagan, von Bush I administrations became the senior players in von Bush II's administrations. And they haven't gone away. Yeah, they're not in office anymore, but they're still there. And the people that were placed in positions of power are still wielding influence. Pat Buchanan's successor, for example, in becoming White House communications director in 1985, a fellow named Kohler was forced to resign when it came out that he'd been in the Hitler Youth. The person in charge of presidential liaison for Ronald Reagan was none other than Ekaterina Chumachenko, the point element for the OUNB. The Ukrainian fascist element that collaborated with the Third Reich was involved with the Galen Org and the ABN that helped to kill President Kennedy, that helped to realize rollback or liberation theory, and that now Ekaterina Chumachenko is now Ekaterina Yushchenko. She's married to Mr. Yushchenko, the president of the Ukraine, who basically is recapitulating the old OUNB. People like, and do not lose sight of the fact that the Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk, for which this program is titled in part, were published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance. And a National Alliance ally, a fellow named Bob Whitaker, as discussed in FTR 647, was basically in a key position vis-a-vis administering security clearances for the Reagan administration. If the things that I talk about in this program sound weird, way out, and I can appreciate that a certain number of listeners are going, oh, there goes Dave again, talking about Serpent's Walk, talking about how, yeah, the Nazis were put into Reagan's administration. Well, just remember that a National Alliance person, for all practical purposes, was helping to provide security clearances for the Reaganoids. Point being, how are these people, many of whom are still in government of one type or another, how are they going to react with an African-American president? How are they going to react with an attempt, and I think Barack Obama will make a sincere attempt, is making a sincere attempt at getting America back to its democratic with a small d foundations? How are they going to react? Well, you can bet that the Nazi elements and the white supremacist elements are not exactly doing the varsity rag over having a black man as president of the United States, and they will not take this lying down. They're still in place. For example, a guy named Todd Blodgett, who was a Reagan administration White House staffer. He was working with Resistance Records and the Liberty Lobby, helping to crank out Nazi punk rock or Nazi black metal music. These people are still there. And that is part of the von Bolschwing axis. Now, we concluded the program last week talking about the alliance between von Bolschwing and the Nazis and the Getty elements. J. Paul Getty was a friend of Hitler, helped to ship oil to the Nazis in the early pre-war and early World War II period. The Gettys have remained very close to elements within the Democratic Party. One of Otto von Bolschwing's close personal friends and business partners, a director of his TCI Electronics Company, was Judge Appellate Justice William Newsom, now retired. His son, Gavin Newsom, is now mayor of San Francisco. They're very close to the Gettys. And the Newsoms and the Pelosis are also in-laws as well. We spoke about that last week. Now, also last week, we were talking about Karl Rove's heritage as well, good old 666 himself. And I'm going to review very briefly an element of Karl Rove's background. The book The Architect, authored by James Moore, discusses Karl Rove's familial background And in an interview, James Moore described Rove's background and his interview with Karl Rove. Rove's response was, "Well, my senior year in high school, my dad was coming home on Christmas Eve. He'd gotten a new job, a huge job, as the chief geologist at Getty Oil Company in Los Angeles. We were going to celebrate my birthday the next day." Rove's father, actually his stepfather, was the chief geologist at Getty Oil. And Getty Oil, like many of the other major corporations that was allied with Hitler, did not change its stripes. The point being that not only are there, say, for the sake of argument, Bormann Democrats, and keep an eye on Gavin Newsom, keep an eye on Nancy Pelosi, whose husband Paul became a billionaire in the gaming machine industry. Doesn't everybody? And who is married into the Newsom family. Watch Nancy Pelosi very subtly undermine Barack Obama, but coming from the left. Keep your eyes on that one. But we're launching into the substantive discussion. I want to enlist the assistance of members of the listening audience. I'm going to access some allegations about Karl Rove's family background, and bear in mind that some of the Rove siblings were sired by one father and some of the others by another. Rove remained very close to his father, who was the chief geologist, or the fellow who became the chief geologist at Getty Oil. He was gay, and his mother, that is to say Rove's mother, committed suicide during the Bush administration. There has been an allegation that's been out on the internet for years about Rove's background. I have never accessed it. I'm going to access it now with a caveat. Instinct does play a role in any sort of journalistic endeavor, and it plays a role in what I do. The information that I'm about to present, or the allegations I'm about to present, are certainly very interesting. I suspect that in their essence they are substantively true. I also suspect, and this is instinct, that there is some deliberately secreted disinformation within this, probably secreted or introduced by Karl Rove himself in order to badjacket any serious research into Rove's background. Counterpunch of October 6th of 2003 accessed the following information. This is from an article called Fourth Reich, the Bush-Rove-Schwarzenegger Nazi Axis, co-authored by Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman. And again, this is from Counterpunch, October 6th of 2003. Now, this alleges a direct Nazi background, a direct Third Reich background for Rove's grandfather. I have not been able to find any corroborating evidence. I have seen internet chatter about a slight element of disinformation, indicating that there may have been one or two legitimate errors or perhaps deliberate skewing of this. But remember that Karl Rove is a master at badjacketing things. Look what he did to J.H. Hatfield and the Bush cocaine story. In all probability, Rove was behind the 60 Minutes gambit in which Dan Rather lost his job for having presented what was largely accurate but partially inaccurate information about the Bush National Guard service. But again, note the following, and if people can assist me by checking with databases, particularly German databases or overseas databases, I will be most appreciative. But again, I suspect that what follows is in its essence accurate and substantively so. But I suspect that there's some disinformation in here. That is why, even though this is more than 5 years old, I have not used it until now. But with Rove's dad, to whom he was very close, having been the chief geologist at Getty Oil, I mean, this guy wasn't going out and taking core samples to see where to drill for oil. This guy was putting pins in maps and deciding where the tanks were going to roll, so to speak. Fetrakis, rather, and Wasserman write, after talking about some of the Nazi background of the Bush family and the Schwarzenegger family, and also talking about how Karl Rove was deeply involved with getting Schwarzenegger elected governor of California, Fetrakis and Wasserman write, "Karl Rove has parallel ties. The shadowy Rove serves as Bush's brain in the current White House. He is the political mastermind behind the California coup and is now in the headlines for outing Valerie Plame, the CIA wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson. A consummate strategist, Rove may have outed Plame in retaliation for Wilson's failure to back up the Bush claim that Saddam Hussein was buying nuclear weapons material in Africa. According to some published reports, as many as 70 CIA operatives had been put at risk by Rove's retaliatory strike. According to Joseph Wilson and to retired U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander Al Martin of www.almartinraw.com, Rove's grandfather was Karlheinz Roverer, the Gauleiter of Oldenburg. I've also seen it as the Gauleiter of Mecklenburg in different accounts. Continuing, Rover was Reich Stadthalter, Nazi State Party chairman for his region. He was also a partner and senior engineer in the Roverer Süddeutsche Ingenieurbüro AG engineering firm, which built the Birkenau death camp at which tens of thousands of Jews, gypsies, dissidents, and others were slaughtered en masse. I would appreciate any help people can find in digging up information about the alleged Nazi background of Rove's grandfather. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. And one of the things that has always intrigued me about Rove's background is the fact that when you look at the guy, he looks like a German banker. And I've often wondered about whether there might be when the Nazis went underground, sort of a Boys from Brazil scenario in which young Nazis or promising young Nazis were placed abroad with sympathetic families. That would not be much of a stretch from what we can read about in the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees. That was published before D-Day in 1944. It's available for download for free on the Spitfire website. But bear in mind that Karl Rove, he ain't going to go away, folks. And his family heritage goes back to Getty Oil. Von Bolschwing was very close to Getty, very close to Hitler. So who knows? But don't ever lose sight of the fact that one of the reasons why things were so rotten in the past 8 years is they were supposed to be rotten. This administration, I think W was just a puppet, but this administration wasn't supposed to govern America intelligently. It was supposed to ruin America and beyond that to loot it for certain interests, corporate interests, but primarily foreign corporate interests as well. The U.S. under two George W. Bush administrations could be compared with some of the planes that were hijacked on September 11th. They weren't supposed to effect good landings, and they weren't supposed to reach their destinations. They were supposed to do what they wound up doing, which was to become devastated, to devastate others and devastate themselves. And that wouldn't be a bad metaphor for the Bush administrations. But the reasons why they didn't work out was because they weren't supposed to work out. And one of the things that we have seen in the last 8 years, we have seen a huge rise in the scapegoating of Jews for the depredations, the various gambits of the petroleum industry, the Iraq War in particular. I talked about that at considerable length in For the Record 613. So don't lose sight of how, quote, neocons, really a code word for Jews in a lot of circles, have been scapegoated for what the petroleum industry has been doing. And don't forget who was in charge, basically. Karl Rove was the real string puller in this administration. And who knows about his background? Yeah, his father was the chief geologist at Getty Oil. How about his grandfather? Are those allegations from Al Martin, Lieutenant Commander Al Martin, and before that, Joseph Wilson, are they accurate? I would appreciate any help that people can provide in accessing that. As I said, just at a pure instinctive level, I suspect that's been seeded with some disinformation to discredit it. That's one of the reasons that's the main reason I haven't talked about it before. Journalists are like a flock of birds. When one lands on a wire, they all land. When one flies away, they all fly away. And I think that Rove has become a true master of doing that. By the way, another master of doing that was Heinrich Müller, head of the Gestapo and the director of security for the Bormann Organization. A number of programs have talked about that, For the Record 155 among them. Now, we're going to be taking a look at the Serpent's Walk scenario, how gaining control of the opinion-forming media can be used to basically precipitate political change. To make a long story short, if you control the educational system and the media, you have established the grounds for totalitarianism. If people can't get accurate information, how can they possibly act intelligently and constructively? You can lead them down the primrose path. That's why Serpent's Walk is predicated upon the underground right gaining control of the opinion-forming media. Before I wince and take a deep breath and once again venture into one of the journalistic areas that is most unpleasant to deal with, namely the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and also the OJ situation to a certain extent by way of comparison. I'm going to read a portion of a column, and this entire column will be available in the For the Record supplemental section, and excerpts will be available in the description for this program. It's called The Bullets in My Inbox. It's by Ethan Bronner from the New York Times of January 25th, 2009. Faisal Husseini, a Palestinian leader who died at the start of this decade, used to tell a story about his first visit to Israel. The 1967 war had just ended, borders were suddenly open, and he took a drive to Tel Aviv, where at some point he found himself detained by an Israeli policeman. Questions and answers ensued. At one point, the policeman said to him, "As a proud Zionist, I must tell you," unquote, at which point Mr. Husseini burst out laughing. "What's so funny?" the policeman asked. "I have never in my life," Mr. Husseini replied, "heard anyone refer to Zionism with anything but contempt. I had no idea you could be a proud Zionist," unquote. And Bronner goes on to comment, "I have written about the Arab-Israeli conflict on and off for more than a quarter century and have spent the past 4 weeks covering Israel's war in Gaza. For me, Mr. Hussein's story sums up how the two sides speak in two distinct tongues, how the very words they use mean opposite things to each other, and how the war of language can confound a reporter's attempts to narrate or a new president's attempts to mediate this conflict in a way both sides can accept as fair. Among Israel's Jews, there is almost no higher value than Zionism. The word is bathed in a celestial glow suggesting selflessness and nobility. But go anywhere else in the Middle East, and Zionism stands for theft, oppression, racist exclusionism. No place, date, or event in this conflicted land is spoken of in a common language. The barrier snaking across and inside the West Bank is a wall to Palestinians, a fence to Israelis. The holiest site in Jerusalem is the Temple Mount to Jews, the noble sanctuary to Muslims. The 1948 conflict that created Israel is one side's war of independence, the catastrophe for the other. After Israel's three-week air, sea, and land assault in Gaza aimed at halting Hamas rocket fire, it is worth pausing to note how difficult it has been to narrate this war in a fashion others view as neutral, and to contemplate what that means for any attempt by the new Obama administration to try to end it. It turns out that both narration and mediation require common ground, but trying to tell the story so that both sides can hear it in the same way feels more and more to me like a Greek tragedy in which I play the despised chorus. It feels like I'm only fanning the flames, adding to the misunderstandings and mutual antagonism with every word I write, because the fervent inner voice of each side is so loud that it drowns everything else out. And again, this whole article, this is from the New York Times of today, January 25th of 2009. The entire article will be in the For the Record supplemental section. And again, please do not neglect the written description to this broadcast, because it will contain very important information that I did not have time to put in the program itself. And inside, too, we're going to be taking a look at the use of the media as a weapon of war as well as propaganda. And we're going to be comparing, once again, the disinformation, one of the things that leads to that extreme polarization and to the tremendous distaste that any objective reporter feels when dealing with this issue. One of those things, in addition to the huge and decisive elements of money and corporate power, and those are firmly on the side of the Arabs because, simply put, they have oil and the Israelis don't. What it's really all about, it isn't about this place, this, and oppress this, and blah, blah, blah. It's about oil and bucks, Jack and Jill, and don't ever lose sight of that. But one of the things that is really insidious in this whole thing, and that is television, the one-eyed monster, 666 itself. Bad news, stay away from it, and I'll tell you more about that in Side 2, because this concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 661, Walking the Snake in the Middle East, Part 2, O.J. Agonistes and Palestinian Pornography. This has been recorded on January 25th of the year 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.